Well, I don't know. I appreciate that very much, and I look forward to coming back. At this point in my life, though, I don't even buy green bananas anymore. So, you know, we'll see what happens. Thanks for those kind words. And they sort of trigger in my mind what Lindsey Graham had to say this past week. As you know, he was at the kids' table for the Republican debate. And apparently he did pretty well, and he was being interviewed the next morning. And Jake Tapper said to him, you know, Senator Graham, you did very well the other evening, and I'd just like to send along my best wishes and congratulations. To which Lindsey Graham said, well, thank you very much, but would you mind sending a little money? So, yep. They vacationed separately. Their differences regarding how to raise their children and manage their finances was widely discussed. It was irresponsibly reported and discussed that they usually slept in separate bedrooms. And yet the world has come to have an enormous appreciation for the marriage between Clementine and Winston Churchill. There is a new book that I'm currently finding interesting. It's simply entitled Clementine, and it's written by Sonia Purnell. And in the book, she explores all of those issues I've just mentioned, but the theme of the book is really the undying love which this woman possessed and shared with not only her spouse, but her time. And she explores where it was that that love began. Clementine Churchill was born into a very dysfunctional family. Her father was a military type who insisted upon blind discipline and loyalty. Her mother was rather weak and frail, something of an addictive, dysfunctional personality. They divorced when Clementine was only 6 years of age. And there she was, this little kid, in this very sophisticated culture where divorce was verboten, a child of divorce. She lived most of her childhood with an enormous sense of insecurity and anxiety and fear, a sense that somehow she was not worthy. And then she went to a boarding school. And there she encountered a wonderful woman whose name was Helen. And Clementine recorded in her diaries that Helen taught her all kinds of wonderful things about how to drink tea properly, what books to read. But most importantly, she wrote, Helen loved me. And so Purnell in her book suggests that there is a school of thought that Winston Churchill may very well not have become the Prime Minister of England without this undying love of his spouse. She loved him when he was a brash young military type. She loved him when he was a young liberal who had parted ways with a conservative and was not very welcomed in many social circles. She loved him through the difficulties of the Second World War and when he finally lost his position. She loved Winston Churchill even when he was dealing with what he infamously called his black dog, the depression that haunted him throughout all of his life. Purnell ends the book by writing that Clementine Churchill is the embodiment of the finest expression that love can be. Most theologians that I read suggest that love is at the very core of the gospel. When everything else is stripped away, most of the things that we have added on throughout the first, second, and third centuries, the real power and the real essence of the gospel of Jesus Christ is this concept of love. And certainly we can understand that that is so because from the lips of Jesus, that word and the admonitions about it and the possibilities which it entertains and the potentials which it pursues are constant. If we were to take one word to describe the life, the work, and the message of Jesus, it would have to be love. I tell you, don't only love your neighbor, love your enemy. I tell you, love one another. Love is of God. God is love. And so we can see why at the heart of the gospel there is this notion of love. And as the early church made its way through the history that we now embrace, over and over again, we have seen love to be at the very core of our greatest moments. As Martin Luther sought to lead the church of his time in an enormous reformation and revolution, it was the concept of love, a loving God who had accepted him, Luther, in the reality of his sin, that seemed to provide him strength. And of course, as we have read of the early church, we know that while it was that the early church was subject to enormous persecution and lived many of its early decades in the catacombs, it was because of the power of love that the early church carved out enormous statuary, in a figurative sense, for the generations that would follow. And as we have observed such people as Mother Teresa, Billy Graham, and now Pope Francis, if you were to try to find a common thread that runs through those terribly diverse lives, it would have to be love. In Mother Teresa's case, words that said, "Thank you, but I choose not to live in the convent. I'm going to live with the people I serve. I love them." In the context of Billy Graham, in his book, Just As I Am, he talks about the fact that his transition from a zoot suitor, tough, hard evangelist to a pastor that embraced America began with his understanding that God is love. And when you look at Pope Francis over and over again, you see his message. Why do we fixate on all of these issues? We are called to love one another. And whenever we talk about that powerful language, of course, all of you know that the Greek word there is agape. And it's very important to understand what it is that we mean by love. Because listen to our vocabularies. We love pumpkin pie. We love a sports team. We love a college. We love a favorite vacation location. And none of those words has anything to do with the notion of the gospel's perception of love, and consequently the meaning of agape. Agape is an other-oriented love. That means it is constantly mindful of what the other needs in order to survive. Likewise, agape is not this warm, fuzzy phenomenon that we see in our time that overuses the word awesome and wonderful for things that are terribly pedestrian. Love is often a kind of critique that says, you know, if you want to pass, student, you got to study. If you want to succeed, you got to work. Have you ever thought that your negativity is the basis for your broken relationships? Every now and then, agape speaks that word that calls someone, the other, out of their own demise. And of course, lastly, agape is all about strength. Certainly in the personage of Jesus, we do not see a man loving out of weakness. We see a man loving out of strength. And as we look at the Mother Teresa's and the Billy Graham's and the Pope Francis's of the world, they are strong people rooted in the enormous love of God. And that brings us to Hanukkah Lights, where Marvin Hamlisch's wonderful lyric celebrates that during the season of the lights, we discover love. And that brings us to Advent lights. As we light the candles, which we don't have, and in most churches today, the liturgical calendar calls for the last candle in Advent to celebrate love. And what I have tried to do this morning is to turn to the Gospel of St. John, reading in the 14th chapter these verses. A new commandment I give you. Love one another as I have loved you. For in so doing, others will know that you are my disciples. Notice that these words spoken by Jesus use the word commandment. Notice that Jesus does not suggest a goal. He does not make a recommendation. It is not a benign suggestion that this might be nice, something to consider. Not at all. Howard Key says that the word here for commandment is likened unto the German word Achtung, which means come to attention. This is something that is terribly important. And as you look at the connotation of this Achtung word, commandment, we discover that it is more than a kind of hollow duty. This isn't about drudgery, meeting your responsibilities. Likewise, this is not a word, a concept, that has to do with punishment. That is, the word here does not suggest that if you don't follow, you'll pay the fiddler. Likewise, this is not something that has about it a sense of the casual. I continue to be amazed by the notion of the casual in our culture. Have you noticed that? We've become a casual culture. And certainly there's a place for that, but it's not here. There's no wiggle room in this concept. It's not something that suggests, you know, it might be a nice idea. Here the word is, I give you a new commandment. And the vitality of the word suggests the following, and I'm indebted to Paul Tillich for this. Tillich suggests that this word commandment has to do with that which is essential to life. The word here is talking about something that if it's not pursued, there's a sadness that occurs. Tillich, you know, was a great student of the concept of being. And he believed that the power and the essence of the Christian faith was to give us, as he says in his great book, the courage to be. That is, to have an existence. And for Paul Tillich, this word commandment has to do with following and doing the kinds of things that encourage and support and allow for existence. And therefore, not to do them, in his language, suggests death. So we add all that up, and I think when Jesus talks about a new commandment, which is love, he's speaking about urgency. He's speaking about something that is absolutely necessary if we're going to find our way through our day. He's not talking about a warm, fuzzy concept which goes around in the world believing that everything is awesome. He's talking about something that is essential to the meaning and the existence of life itself. It's not optional. It's a prerequisite. And notice that he uses the word new. This too is a curious word. The transliteration of it means business not as usual. The word new here has nothing at all to do with some sort of a chronological concept. A new pair of shoes, a new car, a new building. Here it has to do with something that is out of the ordinary. It is something that swims against the current. It is something that is, in the words of Reinhold Niebuhr, counterculture. It's something that is not expected. And if you think about the life of Jesus, that all fits. During these days of Christmas, I am haunted by the notion of how Jesus was reportedly born. The Son of God in a stable? Why not a palace? The Son of God. Shepherds? Why not a couple of diplomats? The Son of God. A manger? Why not a comfortable, carefully prepared birth bed? And as you look at the life of Jesus, really, a carpenter? And as you look at the ministry of Jesus, really, somebody who identified with and related to lepers and harlots, tax collectors, as well as Pharisees and Roman soldiers? Jesus was a new breath in his time. And the new breath was, it was not business as usual. Dietrich Bonhoeffer has a wonderful word that he uses in his book, The Cost of Discipleship. It's a Greek word, means perizon. It's perizon. P-E-R-R-I-S-O-N, perizon. And this is what the word means. Unusual. And what that means is, when we look at a stone, a precious stone, and the assessor says, my, this is unusual, in that it is desirable. It also means unique. In the sense of the word that when we look at the young woman who now is in our United States Congress who lost both legs in Afghanistan, and you say of her life, boy, that was unique, meaning respect. Peculiar. Not in the sense of the word of necessarily being odd, but in the sense of the word of this particular fauna type of plant is peculiar to this region of the world. And you can only see it if you go to that place. Extraordinary. In the sense of the word that when you see it, you know it, even though you've never seen it before. The word new here suggests a whole new level of understanding for people called Christians. It calls us to live with an impetus and an understanding, and I believe an energy that defies description. Well, I'll allow you to see this portion of me. My experience, both coming into, living in, and then exiting out of ministry, has been shaped by a lot of really significant human beings. And one of the things that I learned from most of those individuals was this, that the ministry of the church, the ministry of Christ, is a terribly unique, unusual, peculiar, and extraordinary privilege. And people, when they get around the ministry of the church, should notice it, even though they've never seen it before. It should touch them. It should embrace them. It should summon them. And of course, Harry Emerson Fosdick, the great preacher of another age, once said that the greatest sermons that we'll ever preach do not utilize words. It is behavior and thinking and attitudes and function that reflects parazon, a newness. And then notice more about the text. Jesus says that we are to love as he has loved us. Now, historically, Christians and the church generally have understood those words as Jesus giving us a model by which we are to function. And that's understandable because Jesus was a consummate teacher. Jesus was all about imparting to people ideas and concepts. And he usually did that in ways that were very powerful and yet terribly simple, and always left people with a kind of standard. I often think of Chuck Noll when I think of this component of Jesus. Chuck Noll was, yes, a football coach, obviously, we get that. But Chuck Noll was a consummate teacher. He once said that he did not recruit position players. He recruited athletes. And then he taught them how to play a position. And if you read the books that have been written about Chuck Noll, over and over again, the theme emerges that his greatest teaching was not done with a chalkboard, but it was done in the context of relationships that established standards of behavior, standards of thinking that were terribly efficacious. There's a wonderful book out. It's old now, but it was good, still a good book. It's simply entitled A Sporting Life. And it's the story of Mr. Rooney. And as you know, Mr. Rooney was a gambler. Mr. Rooney played the horses. Mr. Rooney grew up on the north side, and he knew every bookie, every prostitute on the north side. He lived a sporting life. But in that wonderful book, there is clearly the discussion that he was so much more than that. He was the guy who, when one of the groundskeeper at Three River Stadium suffered a stroke, Mr. Rooney said, "Take him to Mercy Hospital, and whatever he needs, get it for him and send me the bill." Mr. Rooney was the man who took Joe Green, that hulk of a man, and transformed him into a legend. He was the man who taught Terry Bradshaw, a young, brash racist from Louisiana, to be more. In the book, it's clear that Mr. Rooney, like the man he hired, was a teacher. Jesus also was a teacher. And so when we hear these words, we say, oh, well, how did Jesus love? And then we try to emulate that. How did Jesus love? Well, we try to duplicate it. And there's certainly a place for that. However, my notion is that these words mean more than, hey, here's the standard, try to live up to it. I think these words suggest that Jesus is saying to us, I have loved you. Pay it forward. Have you ever noticed that when we hear about Jesus loving, let's say, people who denied him or people who deserted him, we always manage to put those qualities onto others. And rarely do we think of ourselves as being in those roles. Whenever we think about Jesus loving someone who didn't understand, such as his disciples, when we call ourselves a disciple, it never occurs to us that maybe there have been moments when we didn't get it either. So I think that these words, love others as I have loved you, do not only offer us the standard that we are to pursue, I think it also offers us the motivation that allows for the standard to be fulfilled. Because whenever you remember that you were a sinner, welcomed by God, you stand in the tradition of the Pope who said, who am I to judge? Whenever you are the person whose value has been totally decimated by your own actions, and nevertheless have been embraced by the love of God in Christ, when you stand in the presence of another who has had the same experience, piling on is not permitted. These words of Jesus, I think, are terribly powerful in that they remind us that all of us have been loved by God in Christ in a way that we have not deserved. And therefore, as we move out into our worlds, dealing with people who do not deserve it, we are mandated to nevertheless be it. I think that is what a fellow by the name of Saul of Tarsus came to understand. You know, on that road to Damascus, he was, without a doubt, a very, very unsavory character. And yet God's love reached out to him and embraced him. And as a result of that, Paul embraced the Greco-Roman world with the gospel. It's what Martin Luther, I think, discovered in his search for spiritual peace. There's a wonderful play entitled The Young Man Luther. In one of the scenes, one of the prayer services in the monastery where young Martin was a candidate, depicts all of the monks praying, you know, Lord have mercy, Christ have mercy, Lord have mercy. And over in the corner, there is the young man Luther who is screaming out at the top of his voice, Lord, have mercy on me. And we learn from that the meaning of the Protestant Reformation, yes, was of course institutional in many ways. But it was really Martin Luther's search for spiritual peace. And once he found it, he shared it. And it is what Pope Francis is telling us, as now he has opened the great door of mercy in Rome. I thought of that this past week. We had finals this past week. You know, that's always a wonderful time on a campus. You remember those days, don't you? Everybody's really rested and has eaten well and feels good about themselves and others. And it's all about bonding and love and grace and peace and being awesome. Yeah. And as I walked onto the campus, It's my practice. I start my day there by going into the basilica and just sitting down and thinking. And as I made my way toward the basilica, there the doors of the basilica were literally, but also figuratively opened with the papal flag over them. The door of mercy is open. As we walk through that door, let's make sure that we keep it open for the person who's coming behind us. Love one another as I have loved you. And then the footnote in this text. Jesus says that by these kinds of attitudes and behaviors, others will know that we are his disciples. Well, that presents us with a curious dilemma. Because these words have nothing at all to do with proselytizing. They have nothing at all to do with being noticed. They have nothing at all to do with being applauded and appreciated. Every time I read these texts and the people who write about them, I remember my years in Mars, a little community in the North Hill serving a Methodist church there. And there was a woman in that church who taught the MISPA Bible class. And she had done that for, well, just shortly after the Ark returned from its journey. Yeah. She got off the Ark and began to teach the class. And she decided that she was going to give it up. And one night at a board meeting, she announced that. And in that context, she said, "And I don't know," and her voice trembled, "I don't know what's going to happen to the class." Well, there was a wonderful fellow in the church. His name was Frank Hartung, and rather ironically and prophetically, he was also a carpenter. And he said, "Well, Louis, if you want to know something of the answer, try this. When you go home tonight," he said, "go into the kitchen and draw up a basin of water." And he said, "then take your finger and make a hole in the water. Pull out your finger. See how long the hole lasts." What was his point? Gee whiz, Louis. Maybe you've done this for the wrong reasons. To be applauded and appreciated, noticed. And certainly beyond that, to make other people be Christians. Lest I be misunderstood, I certainly do not shy away from sharing the gospel with another in the hope that perhaps they will find in it something meaningful. But did you hear what I just said? That they will find in it something meaningful. It has nothing at all to do with me. It has nothing at all to do with populating the pews. It has nothing at all to do with those annual reports that say, "yeah, we've taken in 850 new members." It has much more to do with what Dietrich Bonhoeffer once called secret discipline. You know, he operated with the idea of hiddenness in terms of how we live out our faith. And he said, we are to remain hidden so that the wonder and the glory of God can shine through us. I think that is what Jesus is suggesting here. I don't think Jesus is mandating me to go to the young man who was my surgeon several years ago, whose name is Benjamin Davies, who happens to be a Jew, and say to him, "you know, have you ever thought about being a Christian?" Neither do I think that these words are about living in a way that people notice me and say, "oh my." I certainly don't think it's about Louis in the MISPA class and being applauded and appreciated. I think it's about living out our faith in significant, dynamic ways that remain, that cause us to remain hidden, so that the wonder and the goodness of God can be seen. There are lots of people out there today who are saying that we're living in a different time. Of course we are. Have you looked into a mirror lately? We're all very different, aren't we, than we were 25 or 30 years ago? Of course it's a different time for me to go to spring training in February and watch a couple Pirate games. 25 or 30 years ago meant being in a car for 32 hours. Now I go out to the airport and can be there in 30 hours. No, just kidding. Of course the age we're living in is different. But you know, it's strikingly the same. In another time, Christians could have remained hidden in ways that would have allowed for Jews to escape the Holocaust. And Barbara and I heard one of those Christians when we visited Scandinavia several years ago. And we listened to the son of a fisherman who saw to it that Jews were exported out of Germany secretly by night in his boat and brought to freedom. We can duplicate that by, in a hidden way, announcing to our time that not all Muslims are terrorists. I think that in a different age, people like my mom and dad were thought to be lower middle class. We didn't have a car. We didn't have a phone either. We didn't have a bathroom. We lived in a rented house. And there, thank God there were Christians who in a hidden kind of way said, you know, let me help you get your kid into college. Today in our culture, there are all kinds of people who are considered lower middle class. I stood behind one several months ago in a pharmacy as a frail elderly woman was confronted with two prescriptions. And the pharmacist said, this one is covered. This one isn't. To which the old woman said, I'll take the one that is. And I couldn't help but wonder what the second prescription was for. There are people in our time, the old, the frail. How about the young and the goalless? How about the people who have been set aside as being brown? We have an opportunity in a hidden kind of way to suggest that value is a matter of the soul, not the pocketbook. In our time, we remember another age. And have you ever noticed that when we remember yesterday, it's always wonderful? The good old days. Well, I don't know about your good old days, but back in my good old days, there was plenty of violence. And there was lots of hatred. And there was lots of divisiveness. But I remember people like Walter Gross and Miss Duffy, who taught us that there was a better way. In the age in which we live, violence, hatred, divisiveness, they're still with us. And I think in a hidden kind of fashion, we can address those commandments. So then Jesus says, I give you a new commandment. It's not a suggestion, by the way. It's not business as usual. And this is it. Love one another as I loved you. And remember, I loved you when you denied and you misunderstood, and you deserted. And do that, my friends, so that others will know that you are a disciple of mine, not themselves. These are glorious times in the life of the church. And I think one of my favorite hymns during this era is this: Love came down at Christmas. Love incarnate. Love divine. Love was born at Christmas. A sign seen by angels and shepherds. That's all I have. Anybody have any comment or question? You've been very quiet these last 4 weeks. I've been very nervous about that. Each week, Barbara and I go home, and we say, my glory, that must have fallen flat on its face, because it wasn't. Nobody responded. And I do apologize for kind of being a little preachy, because when I was given this assignment, I realized I had one of two options. I could lecture you about the discipline of Advent, and I could have given you a little, for example, we could have made a little Advent candle wreath, you know, a little handcraft, or we could have done another number of, but I decided that maybe we needed to, you know, look at some depths of ideas. So that's what we've tried to do. Anybody want to raise anything about love? No? Well, yes, sir, please. Let me, great, incidentally, a marvelous question. Why? Because it speaks to something that is inherent in the text, but is absent from it. And that is, nowhere in the text does Jesus say this is ever going to be simple or easy. Okay? So let's start there. It's not simple or easy. Secondly, I would respond by sharing with you the life of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. A great deal is by reference this morning of what he talked about was love, discipleship, hiddenness, caring for others. He came to England where he encountered the teachings of Gandhi, and so he returned to Germany with this sense of passive resistance, started his underground seminary, his underground church, tried to get people to think in terms of resisting Nazism and Hitler. Guess what? Nothing worked. And so Dietrich Bonhoeffer, along with his brother-in-law, devised the infamous plot to assassinate Adolf Hitler. When I was in grad school, the writing of Bonhoeffer had just really become in vogue. As you know, he wrote everything he wrote was published posthumously. So it took a little while for Dr. Bethuge to get this stuff done and put together. And I can remember sitting in seminars with guys who smoked pipes and carried briefcases and who were about as real as cartoon figures, going on about how they had no idea how it was that Bonhoeffer could have ever participated in that kind of behavior. Well, if you grew up in the neighborhood where I did, it wasn't a big leap to figure out that every now and then, it's not a matter of right and wrong. It's a matter of the lesser wrong or the better good. And that gets very complex and very difficult. So, I'd like to use this occasion to announce that I am running for the presidency of the United States. And I'm going to be debating Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump tomorrow afternoon Yeah, at McDonald's down here. Yeah, no. So to become specific, we're living in a time, for example, in the Middle East. Hey, there aren't any easy answers over there. And therefore, I think that prudence requires us to examine our alternatives carefully. But I also think that conscience every now and then requires us to make choices and decisions that aren't necessarily popular and do not necessarily avoid the tragedy of the loss of human life. I sometimes think about what kind of a world it might have been if Bonhoeffer had been successful in that plot. And if you want the answer to that question, what you need to do is you need to talk to some people who are still around who have their number tattooed on their hand. Or maybe other people who lost dads and moms and brothers and sisters and spouses who had numbers tattooed on their hands. So that for me, love is not a willy-nilly kind of everything goes, never making the hard decision issue. I don't think it is at all. I think it requires sometimes our making a choice that is so awful. But what's the option? That's the best I can come up with. Please.
Mm-hmm. Row of other efforts.
Exactly.
All kinds of stuff that were tried. So this wasn't the first thing he thought about. Mm-mm. And the other thing is that he writes that he knows that this is wrong. Mm-hmm. He knows he's sinning when he does this, but he does it anyway, and he asks for God's mercy, and that's the best he can do.
Right. So. Sure. I mean, I hope you heard all that. I mean, this wasn't, no, it wasn't a knee-jerk reaction. Hitler, Adolf who? Kill him! No. And likewise, it was something that Bonhoeffer decided with enormous anxiety and guilt. But maybe we need to be there every now and then. At least that's, people often say to me, do you miss the ministry? Of course I do. That's why I so appreciate your invitation to come here, because it gives me an opportunity to interact, to think, to talk, to share. So I miss preaching. And thank God for even that wonderful little Catholic college up the road, because they give me an opportunity to teach. I miss the pastoral concern. You know, this week, for example, we learned a very close friend lost a 5-month-old baby, granddaughter, to SIDS. And everything in me, pastorally, came alive. So I miss that. You know what I don't miss? The meetings and the administration. Why? Yeah, because of the boredom. You know, most church meetings you can wrap up in a bow and, you know, sell on eBay. But the thing that I really don't miss is the hard decisions that people have to make. For example, when you deal with a staff member, which I did on several occasions, who was not doing their job, and I had to go to them and say, look, this is what we need. And the response to that, well, I'm not going to do that. And then I had to say, well, I'm sorry, I have to let you. We have to terminate you here. And boy, I'll tell you, if you've done that anywhere, you know that you don't win points for being the Christian of the month. In fact, there are some other words that are used rather venomously about you. I'm so glad you used that word, that he was sinning. Because I think that whenever we have to make those hard choices, people that say it doesn't bother them, there's something wrong there. Either they don't get it or they're whacked. You need to be bothered. And, you know, I don't know if you've ever, have you seen anything by this guy McChrystal, who was a general who was relieved of his command in Afghanistan. Yeah. Well, you know, he's teaching up at Yale now. And we heard him several years ago give a lecture. And one of the things he talked about in his book and also in his lecture was the unbelievable sense of doing wrong whenever you order a strike. Because you know that there are kids and old ladies and old men and innocents in that village that are going to die. You also know that if you don't do that, other people, maybe more people, are going to die. And it's a constant choice. So yeah, it's not simple. No, I'm sorry.
One thought about one of my first, you know, protection is a part of life.
Yes.
A mother protects their baby from being harmed. And in some way, there must have been some thought in his mind that he was protecting Jews. And he was protecting Hitler from doing worse evil things than...
No question about it.
...that he went on to do. So that he was up against the wall, there was nothing else he could do, but he had to protect. He had to do what he could to do to protect people, including Hitler.
Yeah, from himself.
Yes, from himself.
Yeah, I think that's...
Or if
yeah.
We have an insane person who's about to ignite a bomb and destroy other lives, maybe even shooting that person, if you're a police officer, what else can you do? If you don't do that, then all these other people get killed.
Exactly.
These are hard choices.
Yeah, they are.
But they're also, in a way, a part of love.
Yeah, and when I was listening to you, I began to think about how it is that whenever you make that hard choice, motivation as to why you're making it becomes absolutely essential. If you're making it out of, oh, hell, bang, or if you're making eyes black, bang. Or if you're making it out of the sense that somehow he's just the enemy, bang. Maybe not so good. But if you're up against the wall and you're saying, you know, I've got millions of Jews that are disappearing here. And I know where they're going. I got to do something. That's a whole different, I think, motivation. And I'm glad you raised police officers, because I think in today's culture, one of the most challenging, difficult jobs that we can ask a human being to do is to be a police officer. Because think about it. Not only are they required to make those kinds of choices, they're required to make them in fractions of seconds. And who among us is going to stand up and say that a person is wrong until we've been in that moment? That doesn't mean that we don't have review boards. It doesn't mean that we don't investigate. It doesn't mean any of that at all. It just means that we develop an empathy, an awareness that it's not simple out there. Never has been. And I guess that brings me back to my obvious sarcastic comment about love being understood as this warm, fuzzy thing that everything's wonderful and awesome. Well, I got a newsflash for you. It isn't always wonderful. You know, I had a kid in my class this semester who ended up, you know, she ended up getting a D. And she's not a happy camper. If I can't wait to see her student review. It'll probably go on YouTube. Bastard of the month, right here. You're looking at it. Maybe the semester, maybe the academic year, maybe all time. I don't know. But I hated doing it. I really did. I hated doing it. But I had no choice. What was I weighing? I was weighing against Malik, who comes from Buffalo, New York, who's being raised by a single mom, who started off with a 60 in the first exam and came to me and said, Doc, what do I need to do? And I said, Malik, you need to do A, B, C, D, and E. And by God, he did it. So am I going to throw him to the wind? What am I going to do with the other students who put up with my nonsense all semester, wrote the papers, took the exams, read the books, and say, guess what, none of that counted? Of course not. But it doesn't make the decision any easier, and certainly it does not preclude the critique and the criticism that will result from those decisions. Well, thank you so much for having us. We'll see you in a year or so. Yeah.